I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Earlier this year, Toyota unveiled the Mirai. It's a hydrogen fuel cell car that has a 300-mile range, takes just a couple of minutes to refuel, and emits water vapor in its exhaust pipe. Elon Musk, the founder of Tesla Motors and a proponent of electric cars, calls hydrogen fuel cells fool cells and extremely silly. Well, it looks like the battle for greener cars is heating up and that hydrogen cars are finally making their debut after years of will they, won't they. Joining us is John Volker. He's editor-in-chief of Green Car Reports. He has driven electric cars and hydrogen fuel cell cars and alternative fuel vehicles. And John Volker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So how does a hydrogen fuel cell car work? How does that technology work?
You fill up a very highly pressurized tank with hydrogen at a hydrogen fueling station, which operates more or less like a gas station, except the thing that you plug into your car is heavier. It's aircraft quality. The pressurized hydrogen is fed into what's called a fuel cell stack, which combines it with oxygen from the air to produce water vapor and electricity. It's H2, which is hydrogen, plus O, oxygen, and it makes water, H2O, and a lot of electricity, because hydrogen has a very strong propensity to combine with other atoms to make compounds. It's a good energy carrier. And that electricity drives an electric motor that turns the wheels, just like in an electric car. But instead of being powered by a large battery pack, as in the Tesla, it's powered by this that sits under the hood or in some other part of the car. And there's a very small battery about the size of one in a hybrid car to try to handle the most extreme power demands for short periods.
And where does that hydrogen come from? I mean, it's very plentiful, obviously, but I was reading that it comes from natural gas.
There are a number of ways to make hydrogen. And while you'll hear, as you said, that it's the most plentiful element in the universe, you actually have to put a lot of energy into something else to get pure H2 that you can use in vehicles. It's bound up in other molecules, be it water, which you can put electricity in to crack out the hydrogen. But the most common feedstock, as we say, at the moment, is natural gas. You put a lot of energy into natural gas, it splits out the hydrogen that you then compress or transport. Some fueling stations will do this right at the station location. They'll make their own fuel there. Others will transport it in pipelines.
So what is it like to drive a hydrogen fuel cell car?
It's pretty much like driving a regular electric car with a few added noises. I do have to say, in fairness, it's certainly not like driving a Tesla, which is an extremely high-performance electric car. I drove the Mirai last fall in its final prototype form, and roughly it has the performance of a Toyota Prius.
Okay.
But an electric Toyota Prius without a gasoline engine that switches on. So it's quieter and smoother. But you do, to some extent, hear the pumps and compressors and vents and so forth, which you don't in an electric car. That said, it's pretty much the same as driving an electric car. It's smooth, there's no transmission shifting, and it just goes.
And in terms of the exhaust, I mean, what it emits is water, H2O?
Yep. It actually accumulates the water in a little tank, and then every so often it vents it out, so you get a dribble of water out the tailpipe.
And can you drink it? I mean, is it clean enough to drink?
It's funny, because there have been demonstrations on YouTube of people doing that.
Yeah.
The Toyota folks, who are extremely cautious, say, well, you know, you really shouldn't, because the tailpipe is open to the road, and you could get road dust in there. The water itself is fine, but, you know, getting it sort of from its little tank out the pipe, you might get some contaminants. But it's basically water.
So what has taken so long? And perhaps it just, I mean, this is new technology, obviously, and perhaps complicated technology, but this has been talked about for probably a couple of decades now.
Indeed. And the hydrogen skeptics, of which there are a number, have frequently said hydrogen is the fuel of the future and always will be. It's a complicated technology in the sense that there's a lot of very basic material science and chemistry in this fuel cell stack. There's a lot of technology around figuring out how you store hydrogen in these long tubes that are built into the chassis of the car under extremely high pressure. We're talking 10,000 pounds per square inch, and keep that safe in accidents. Automakers are very, very good at designing structures to crash and protect their occupants and not blow up, but there is a lot of work around that. And it's also a matter of setting up a supply chain. This stuff at automotive quality, at the prices that people will want to pay for automobiles, doesn't really have an industrial production base. And then on top of that, and the biggest sort of question for consumers is, where do you actually go to fuel the thing up?
Exactly.
And at the moment, there are something like 24 hydrogen fueling stations. I don't think it's even that high in North America right now. California has a plan to get to 100 hydrogen stations by 2020. That number will accommodate about 25,000 cars, if I remember the numbers correctly. So really, you have to build this very large infrastructure of fueling stations spaced relatively predictably so that you can go 200 miles on the highway and then refuel, and you have one every so often in denser urban areas. But you don't want to have to drive half an hour to fuel your hydrogen vehicle, so the placement of the stations is going to depend on who uses these cars, and it's a kind of a chicken and egg problem. It's also very expensive to build hydrogen stations. They run probably in bulk $1 million or more a piece, which is it's at least 10 times the cost of a DC fast charging station for electric cars. But, the government of California is subsidizing some of these stations, as are the car makers, to kick the project off.
You had mentioned safety and crashes. I mean, what does happen? Perish the thought of someone driving a hydrogen fuel cell car and they do get in an accident. What potentially happens?
The same thing that happens in any other kind of car. The dangerous stuff, the hydrogen tanks, or in the case of a gasoline car, a modern gasoline car designed to the latest standards, the gasoline tank is protected. It's in the center of the car down low, and the entire car and the structure of the car absorbs the crash forces around it, and the gas tank or the hydrogen cylinders simply stay where they are.
Hmm. You had mentioned Tesla, and I said in my introduction, Elon Musk talking about fuel cell. I mean, is this just, rich and innovative car makers kind of trash-talking each other?
Well, Mr. Musk is never shy about saying what he thinks.
No, I've noticed that about him. Right.
Which is one of the reasons that so many Green Car Reports readers really eat up anything about Tesla. He's kind of a Thomas Edison at this point. But the discussions and, in some cases, battles between advocates of plug-in electric cars and advocates of hydrogen fuel cell cars are really somewhat surprising in their vociferousness and, in some cases, anger. There are a couple of sort of high-level challenges to hydrogen. One is building these fueling stations and the whole infrastructure therein. Another one is when you look at what we call wells-to-wheels energy, which is the amount of energy you have to put in to move a mile in a vehicle, not just from the tank to the wheels, fueling it up, but also what goes into making that fuel. And so almost all of the data out there show that if you take the same electricity source to recharge a battery electric car uses half to a third as much energy for a mile traveled in that car as if you use that same electricity to create hydrogen out of a feedstock, compress the hydrogen, transport it to somewhere, pump it into the car, and then convert it back to electricity to run the electric motor at a fuel cell stack efficiency of maybe 50 or 60%. The challenge is just that electric cars are more efficient users of energy, and you don't have to go through all of these prior steps to create a fuel that gets then turned back into energy. So in the end, while both hydrogen and electric cars are more efficient than your average gas car, electric cars are far more efficient on average per mile, or use less energy, if you like, than hydrogen vehicles.
Have you driven
and then the final question?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, and the final question really is, what's going to be the cost of the fuel? You'll forgive me for not knowing the electricity rates in Philadelphia, but depending on what you pay for electricity, generally in an electric car, it costs you one half to one fifth as much per mile to run on electricity as it does to run on gasoline. Electric cars are just a lot cheaper because they're very efficient, and electricity is remarkably cheap as a form of energy. It's very unclear, assuming that you get a large hydrogen fueling infrastructure built over the next 10 or 15 years, how much that fuel is actually going to cost the people who fill up their hydrogen cars. At the moment, the target is to equal the cost of gasoline on a sort of per mile basis. But again, that somewhat handicaps the hydrogen car against electric cars, which admittedly have their own problems in terms of low range and longer recharging times. But in terms of actual cost at the pump or at the socket, it's very much unknown how much hydrogen fuel is going to cost, whereas we do pretty much know how much it costs to recharge an electric vehicle.
And we're almost up on a break here. Have you driven a Tesla?
I have.
And what's it like?
It's pretty remarkable. I haven't driven the highest performance version. That's kind of top of my list right now. But, you know, the auto media industry, including myself, often tends to be fairly conservative. The Tesla has changed a whole lot of minds among people who thought that electric cars were nerdy and slow and incapable and boring and only for green eco geeks and so forth, because it's really fast, it's really powerful, it's smooth, it has no tailpipe emissions, and it's good looking.
Well, on that note, we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation with John Volker. He's editor-in-chief of Green Car Reports, and we are talking about hydrogen fuel cell cars, I guess, versus electric cars. That's the way the debate is being framed today. And to join our conversation, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. John will be with us for the next 10 minutes or so. Then we'll be talking about self-driving cars. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. I'm talking with John Volker, editor-in-chief of Green Car Reports. We just had an explosion of phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. John, before we get to some of our callers here, but as long as oil is as cheap as it is today, is that going to hold back these green cars or greener cars that we've been talking about?
To some degree, but it's important to differentiate between hybrid cars and plug-in cars, which people buy for different reasons. At this point, hybrid cars are really all about gas mileage. And as gasoline gets cheaper, people buy fewer of them. There's 15 years of data out there to show that. Thus far, there doesn't appear to be a lot of effect of gas prices on the sales of plug-in cars, in part because they're still more about early adopters, but also because, among other things, they can often be a nicer driving experience than gasoline cars, and that word slowly gets out there. There are a lot of people who will say, once you drive electric, you never want to go back. And so I think it's important to differentiate the small numbers of plug-in cars we're selling right now from the larger number of hybrids and sort of say that they're different cases.
I've read about something called clean diesel cars. These are diesel cars, but they are being sold as clean or cleaner diesel. Has that proved to be true?
Yes. The diesel standards adopted for 2008 in this country were the most aggressive in the world, and they really clean up diesel exhaust to the point where if you don't listen to the engine from the outside of the car, you would have no ability to tell it's a diesel. There's no smell. There's no soot. They're really among the best things in terms of emission standards. The challenge in the U.S. is that diesel fuel costs more, and diesel cars cost more. And so it becomes a math problem. Do I drive enough miles to offset the added cost of the fuel and the added cost of the vehicle? Now, some people just like the way diesel cars drive. And if you have a traveling salesman route, if you're knocking out hundreds of miles a day or 1,000 miles a week, then diesels are probably going to save you money. But it's a more complicated equation in North America than it is in Europe, where diesel fuel is often tax-advantaged by the government.
Oh, that's interesting. We began by talking about the Toyota unveiling this Mirai, the hydrogen fuel cell car. Are other car companies at least beginning to put their toe into this new technology?
Oh, yes. Pretty much every major global automaker, of which there are a dozen or so, at least has R&D on hydrogen vehicles. Hyundai very quietly has been selling a hydrogen-fueled or leasing a hydrogen-fueled version of its Tucson SUV in California since the middle of last year. The numbers are very small. I think in the 6 months from July through December last year, they delivered 54 of them. But Hyundai actually beat Toyota to the punch with an adapted conventional vehicle. Honda will introduce its fuel cell sedan sometime next year. It'll probably go on sale in the U.S. during 2016. And there are various other car makers that will have low production test fleets. But Hyundai, Honda, and of course Toyota are really the three most aggressive in hydrogen vehicles.
So do you think as goes California, will go the rest of the country eventually?
Possibly.
Possibly.
I think it's too early to handicap, and for the reasons we discussed earlier in the show, there are some headwinds, I think, for hydrogen vehicles, among them that you have to build a fueling infrastructure from scratch, and there are still some cost issues. Battery costs for electric cars come down about 7% a year. Huh. Doesn't sound like much, but over a 10-year period, you're cutting more than half of the cost out, and you know, doesn't help you necessarily for 2011 when they were introduced or 2015, which is now. But around 2020, you get to some interesting places. And we have a saying in the industry, electric cars are about butts in seats. Once you get someone to drive one for a day, they understand it's a real car, it does everything that a real car does, that, you know, the recharging, it may take 4 or 8 hours, but it really takes you 15 seconds to plug it in and then close the door to your garage, and that's that.
The idea I guess if you can organize your life this way, you come home after driving around, plug in overnight, and then the car's ready to go the next morning.
Exactly, just like you do your cell phone. And the other thing is that a lot of companies are starting to provide charging at work. Public charging infrastructure can be a more challenging notion, and it's not clear there's actually any business in it, but it's really cheap for companies to say, you know what, we're going to have a few dozen electric car charging spaces somewhere in our parking lot, and it can be an employee perk, or the employees can sort of cover the costs, but that takes care of the problem for those people who don't have their own garage. It's a slow process, you know, building a new source of energy for vehicles after a century of gasoline and diesel is always going to be slow, but I think the cost and the challenge of hydrogen infrastructure is something of a major problem.
I do want to get a caller in before we have to say goodbye to you, but just a quick little shout out to the Philadelphia Parking Authority. An article today in the paper that EV owners can apply to the Philadelphia Parking Authority to install a curbside charger in front of their homes. They have to get approved, and there's a EV-only parking signs, but nonetheless, a bit of a shout out to PPA and Philadelphia. Let me get Bill from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. Bill, go ahead. You're on the air.
That's Bill, the bicycle rider. On fueling infrastructure, given the long term it takes to put it in place, and the involvement in digging up and so on, where there's already towns and cities built up environments. How about proposing it for the places where we have to move away from rising oceans? And let's take Florida, where it's the most immediate. How about proposing that the low-lying oceanfront areas be the first to get hydrogen infrastructure?
Well, Bill, let me I don't know if you've looked at that, John, or not. I mean, there are parts of this country that are at risk because of rising oceans. It's interesting that California has been pretty proactive on this. Do you see other states getting involved?
California always leads. California has really been the leader in reducing emissions from vehicles since World War II. And you had said earlier, as California goes, so goes the nation question. In the case of vehicle emissions, absolutely. So California is by far 5 or 10 years in advance of the rest of the country on anything having to do with hydrogen.
And do you see hydrogen fuel cell trucks and buses in the future? Is that part of the future?
It's hard to say. There's an interesting debate going on right now about what fuels do you use, i.e. not diesel, for the next generation of heavy trucks, which really, you know, improving fuel efficiency in heavy trucks from 2 to 3 miles a gallon saves you a huge amount of fuel, cuts carbon. There are a lot of discussions out there on variants of natural gas, whether it's compressed natural gas or liquefied petroleum gas. I saw a presentation by Shell Oil that suggested that liquefied natural gas stored at very cold temperatures but very energy dense could be the long-haul fuel of the future. Hmm. Clearly, there's a desire to move away from diesel fuel for all, you know, for every single truck. What that fuel becomes is another question.
On that note, John Volker, thank you so much for joining us in this portion of Radio Times today.
Oh, thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. And again, editor-in-chief of Green Car Reports, and that's published by High Gear Media. Well, decades ago, the driverless or autonomous car was a fantasy, really the stuff of science fiction, but not so today. Earlier this year, a driverless car left San Francisco and traveled across the country to New York City almost entirely without a hitch. Our guest, Alex Davies, is associate editor at Wired and rode 500 miles in an autonomous car. And he joins us to tell us what it was like. He covers transportation for Wired. And Alex Davies, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So what was it like to be, are you driven in an autonomous car? Are you driving an autonomous car? What was that like?
I think the verb we settled on was riding.
Riding,
in an autonomous car.
Fair enough.
because we're not at the point yet where the car is doing all the work, because for this Audi, what it was programmed to do was handle all of the driving only on highway roads. Surface streets are a little more complex, so Audi let that one alone for the time being. In the car we were in, you would drive it from the surface streets onto the highway, enter it into what they call piloted mode instead of self-driving mode, because they're a little cagey about that term.
Right.
Most of the automakers are. And so then for the first 90 seconds or so when the car was doing its own thing, I was a little freaked out, had my hands maybe like 3 or 4 inches off the steering wheel, and I had Audi's lead engineer, who had basically built this car, sitting next to me saying, "Yeah, don't worry.
Really?
Relax. Take your hands back." And within a couple of minutes, I was completely relaxed. And at that point, it got a little boring.
Well, that's interesting. But, I mean, did you kind of – oftentimes when you're driving in a car and you're sitting next to the actual driver of the car, you do have your eyes on the road. Did you sort of keep your eyes on the road to be that – the sort of passenger that is watching what's going on?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, I trusted the technology. I didn't trust it so much that I, you know, would have fallen asleep or started reading a book. And in any case, right now, so this is driving in California, where the current regulations say that automakers and other companies are allowed to build self-driving cars, and they can get them certified by the DMV, but the driver in charge still has to very much be aware of the situation and be ready to take over in case anything happens, because it is still the testing phase of the program. So legally, I was required to keep my eyes on the road, and you know, I wasn't quite relaxed enough to break that law just yet.
So if you wanted to switch lanes, for instance, in this Audi, that would be something you would do as opposed to the car?
Actually, no. This car was designed to switch lanes on its own. So when you go into autonomous mode, you say, this is the speed I want to go. You can set it, you know, 65, 70 miles an hour, and it just goes on its own. And if it sees that, you know, you've got a semi-hauler going 5 miles per hour slower than you are right in front of you, it'll wait until the lane to the left of it is clear, put on its turn signal, move into the lane, pass the semi, and then get back over to the right really, really smoothly.
And has it got cameras and sensors, things like that, that tells it sort of what else is on the road?
Yeah, so this Audi had a suite of sensors. Pretty much all of the self-driving cars out there are using the same basic ingredients. Those are cameras, which are usually used to physically pick up on the lane lines to make sure the car is, you know, staying where it should be. It's using a handful of radars. Some of those focus short distance. Some go long distance, up to 800 feet or so. And those are looking out for cars in front of you. They can even have radars facing backward to do things like rear collision avoidance. And then some of the nicer ones, including this Audi, have what's called a LiDAR, which is a laser scanner. And if you see Google self-driving cars, that's what that big bump on the top of the car is. That's a laser scanner that picks up everything around it in extreme detail.
I remember doing a show years ago about self-driving cars when they first, you know, became such an interesting idea, and many people were poo-pooing them, myself included. But I have to say, when you see what's happened in cars in the last couple of years, the fact that all these safety features that have been put in, the fact that there are these cameras and GPS and Bluetooth and radar and all that, you can sort of see cars going in this direction.
Absolutely, and that's exactly what the automakers want you to think. They're saying, you know, they're very, very cautious and conservative when they talk about the rollout of this technology. You know, they don't even want to consider an age when you never need to drive your car, largely because that's not very good for their business, but also because it could scare off current customers. They're saying, no, we want to help you drive. Because first off, you get what are called active safety systems, which are in lots and lots of cars today, even things pretty far down the market, things like automatic braking in the event of a collision or blind spot monitoring. All these little features are helping automakers build their competence in this area, and they're also helping consumers gain more and more trust because maybe you buy a new Mercedes, you say, no, I don't want a car that drives itself. But the first time it steps in when you're not paying attention and hits the brakes before you rear-end a semi-hauler, you're going to feel pretty good about that technology.
You wrote about this self-driving car that drove across the country from San Francisco to New York City. And amazingly, did it? I think you wrote something like 99% of the time the car did all the driving itself. And that includes, you know, this very dense East Coast that we live in with lots of traffic and detours and things like that. Did it perform better than even its supporters and proponents thought it would?
I think they so that was Delphi, which is a major automotive supplier, which is working on that project. I think they would hesitate to say it performed better than they expected it would, but they were definitely very, very pleased with how it worked. And again, that was a system that they kept to highway driving. But even then, like you get into New York, you have some they said bridges were actually one of their main concerns.
Sure.
With these double-decker steel bridges, especially because the cars use radar. And when you're using a radar return and you're driving in an environment that's surrounded by beams of metal, it's very hard for a conventional radar to specifically pick out what's a car and what's a beam that you're not going to crash into because it's overhead. So that's where they put a lot of their engineering work is into tweaking the software to make sure that what the car is seeing, it understands well. Because even on the highway, as you said, especially around the East Coast, things can get a little dicey.
Yes, indeed. You mentioned Delphi and wrote about this in this article in Wired, a company we've never heard of, but you described their what looks like a century really of innovation. I mean, things that we have relied on, depended on for years.
It is, absolutely. And I mean, Delphi has been around basically as long as the automotive industry has come along. I think, I'm pretty sure they were the guys who created the first in-car radio. So they have a long history of quietly building innovations that then you get in your brand name cars. And I think that's exactly what they're trying to do here is Delphi does not want to sell you a self-driving car with the Delphi name on the side. they're working on this project to build competence and build these various systems, technological systems in terms of hardware and software, that they can prove are safe and then package up and sell to an automaker and say, hey, Toyota, maybe you're not developing a self-driving car, but you can buy these ingredients from us and put it into your new Corolla.
We were talking earlier about, hydrogen fuel cell cars, the sort of technological shift that has to come with that. And with self-driving cars or autonomous cars, it's really much more of a psychological shift. Do you agree with that?
It really is. And I think, like we touched on before, a lot of the consumer acceptance is going to come from people working with technologies that are several steps below full autonomy. Those little things that encourage you, okay, yeah, the car does. This machine is better at paying attention than I am. It doesn't get angry or upset or tired or distracted. But the other shift that will happen is regulators are going to start enforcing this. Not in the short term. This is more of the long view because the technology will be much, much safer. We have something like 30,000 people a year in the United States are killed in car crashes, and that's a really high number. Mm-hmm. And so if automakers start proving that the technology they can offer really is safer, like the way the seatbelt wasn't required before automakers started offering it, and then it proved itself to be a really important safety innovation. And so now you have to have a seatbelt. The same thing with a rear view camera. By 2018, all new cars will be legally required to have a rear view camera. And I think that's the way this kind of technology is going to go.
Well, Alex, we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Alex Davies, associate editor at Wired, joining us as we talk about autonomous cars, self-driving cars. What do you make of this innovation? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499, and stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Alex Davies from Wired about self-driving vehicles, and we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. In fact, Alex said we have an email from Gary, and I can relate to this very much. He says, as a person who likes to drive, I can't wait for autonomous cars. For all the people who want to text, watch videos, put on makeup, and read books while they do what they think is driving. You mentioned the safety issue and the fact that 30,000 people are killed every year in car crashes. This notion of safety, and I think we all, if you drive or walk or ride a bicycle, you see people doing extraordinarily distracting things while they're driving their cars. So is safety sort of the feature going forward, do you think?
Yeah, I think when it comes down to it, safety is really, really what it's all about. The idea that, and I think we're in kind of a funny limbo period in terms of where phone technology and car technology are, because our phones are advanced enough that they've become really, really good at commanding our attention almost all the time. And cars aren't quite good enough yet that that's safe for us to just, play on our phones and check Twitter and Facebook while the car should be doing the driving. But we're not more than a couple of years out from cars taking over a lot more of that work for us. And to Gary's point about liking to drive, that's one thing where the automakers are very careful to say that they don't want to take away your right to drive. This is very much an optional feature. The steering wheel and pedals are still there, and it's more the idea that if you want to do some of the driving, you can. If you don't want to and it's safe, the car can take over. So you get to pick and choose. If you want to take on the curving mountain road, that's you. If you want the car to handle traffic on the 101, it can step in there.
I'm thinking about developing self-driving cars in cities where you do have, obviously, stop signs and traffic lights and cyclists and pedestrians and construction zones. Is that the big challenge, sort of how these cars are going to navigate around all those obstacles?
That is the challenge, yeah, because highway driving for the most part is pretty much solved from a technical standpoint. Now it's a matter of testing it 100% and getting the regulators on board. Urban environments are much, much more challenging because, as you said, there are a million different variables. There are cyclists, you don't always have good lane lines. There are pedestrians. You can have a blown traffic light and a cop directing traffic. And so the computing power that has to go into teaching a car to be able to handle all of these different things is that's the really big challenge here. It's not so much the hardware or even convincing people. The biggest challenge is teaching the cars to drive in the cities.
And I'm thinking about, you know, hand signals, whether it's a cop directing traffic or a cyclist that's, you know, telling the cars behind them, I'm going to make a turn here.
Yeah. Well, actually, Google recently said that they've taught their car to recognize cop hand signals. So, again, it's a difficult challenge, but it is something where we're seeing real progress.
I was also reading that the Uber CEO is interested in a fleet of robo-taxis. So clearly, some people are thinking that self-driving cars can operate in a city.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it's just a matter of getting the technology down and proving that it's safe. But going beyond the personal car that you buy that has some nice features, including autonomous driving, one of the big applications will be cities, especially taxis. And because they can operate really much more efficiently than a human driver can if you don't need someone in it all the time. It can go when you call it on a smartphone app. So, various analysts I've spoken with about this believe that city taxi fleets are going to be one of the most important applications of this, although it'll take a little more time to get there.
I mean, it's fascinating to think that you would, you know, call a taxi on your phone and it would a driverless car would come and pick you up.
Yeah, I think people adapt to this kind of technology pretty quickly. I mean, even if you look at the example of Uber, which is still a human driver, but it's very different from the taxi model where you go out into the street and hail a cab or call the dispatcher and they send one over. You know, it's been a couple of years since Uber hit, and now it's wildly popular all around the world. So again, I think once people see the benefits of this, they're gonna latch on right away.
I do want to talk about the article you wrote today about a first self-driving semi truck. But let me get a couple of callers, and we have David from Central New Jersey joining us on Radio Times. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
And your guest. Starting with driverless cars, and frankly, this should have been done a lot sooner, the costs for these safety innovations should be passed along to the insurers. I just feel like the insurers always get a free ride. You know, when we have an accident, in my opinion, the coverage isn't what it should be, what you pay for. And I think these safety innovations ought to be borne by the insurers, and so should electric cars.
Do you want to take that, Alex?
Sure. Well, insurance is definitely one of the more interesting elements of this question, and it's an industry that's almost certainly going to have to change the way it does things. I don't know how you're going to get them to actually take on the changes of that. That would obviously be something the regulators and government would have to step in and do. But the good news for people who are buying cars that are as close as you can get to autonomous today, which would be like a nice new Mercedes or Volvo that has a lot of active safety features in it, is that insurers are already offering cheaper premiums for those cars because those cars will crash less. Okay. So, and I think the long game is that once human drivers do less and less of the driving, the model will probably shift away from I own a car, so I buy insurance to cover myself, to I buy a car and it comes with insurance because if there's a mistake made, it'll be the machine that makes it.
We have an email from Mike. He says he wants to know, Alex, if you can address how well these cars have done in inclement weather. I guess it would be rain, snow, sleet, hail, all of that. Has that been tested?
Bad weather is definitely one of the big questions here, and it's because it's hard for the sensors to see. Cameras, you know, don't do particularly well at night. Radar has trouble in things like snow and fog, and the same with the laser system. So that's something that, you know, most of the testing going on is done in the Bay Area. These things haven't really, except for fog, haven't really been tested all that much. But if you look at the Delphi trip where they drove from San Francisco to New York, they said they encountered rain, they did some driving at night, and the systems performed better than they did. So it is a challenge, but again, it's not an insurmountable one. It's just a matter of making the software a little better and making sure the hardware is up to the task.
Let me see what Rick from South Jersey has to say. Rick, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
When you're talking about the challenges and they were worried about going across bridges and distinguishing between metal pylons and their own radar, I was curious if you get driving into a real heavily congested place with a whole bunch of other self-driving cars, how are they distinguishing between their own signals and those of other cars?
Have we gotten that far yet, Alex, to be able to answer Rick's question?
You know, I'm not sure we have, because as far as I know, no automaker or tech company has put a fleet of self-driving cars out at the same time. I think presumably it probably wouldn't be that big a challenge. It's not something I've heard anyone speak about. And the nice thing about self-driving cars as they stand now is that they don't need to communicate with each other in any way. They just need to identify other cars as other cars, whether or not they're driving themselves. But the challenge of them picking up on other cars' radar signals and stuff like that is not something I've heard talked about. I'm not sure if that's a problem or not.
A couple of emails saying, you know, this could be good for people with disabilities or perhaps even elderly people that, you know, can't drive or won't drive, that this opens up a possibility for them to be able to get out and about.
Absolutely. And that's a point that Google hits on more than anybody else, because Google's approach to this is very different from what the automakers are doing. Google says, we don't want people to drive anymore. We want to get to a point as quickly as possible where the car doesn't even have a steering wheel or, you know, gas and acceleration pedals. Yeah. The automakers are a little more hedged about this because they really want this to be something that complements people who are already driving. So the idea of saying that, you know, an elderly person or a disabled person can drive it kind of undercuts that point. But Google is really upfront about saying this is the way to increase mobility to more people, you know, to kids who want to get to school on their own, elderly people who shouldn't be driving anymore. They very notably did a test drive in one of those cars with a blind man behind the wheel a year or two ago. So that's definitely a big element of it.
And that's Alex Davies, associate editor at Wired, and we are talking about autonomous cars, self-driving vehicles, and you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Alex, you had a piece today in Wired about the Freightliner Inspiration, and this is the first self-driving semi-truck that is, what, about to hit the road?
So not quite about to hit the road. It's a little tricky with the way the regulations work. This is a truck made by Daimler, which is the company that also owns Mercedes-Benz. So it's a lot of shared technology for what you get in the most advanced S-Class. It's an 18-wheeler, and what it has is the first official self-driving car license plate in Nevada, which is one of a handful of states, along with Michigan, Florida, and California, that are actually allowing self-driving cars in one way. So right now, you could drive this. It's allowed to drive on public roads. That being said, Mercedes or Daimler isn't quite ready to sell it to the public yet. They say they may take as long as a decade before they're ready to actually market this to customers, which I think is more of a very, very conservative estimate than it is an accurate estimate. They'll probably move faster than that. But again, the idea of a self-driving car is scary. Now put that in a 40-ton vehicle. People might get a little freaked out, so they're being very careful with the way they're promising this.
But it sounds the way you write that they believe that it would be safer than trucks driven by human beings.
Absolutely. And again, because the highway technology is basically solved, that's why trucking is going to be one of the more kind of boring applications of self-driving cars, because it won't touch the regular consumer. But it's also going to be really, really important, because I forget, something like maybe like 3,000 to 5,000 people a year are killed in accidents with trucks on the U.S. roads, and that's a pretty big chunk of overall deaths on the roads. And so if you can start solving that, and again, you have issues with drivers who are tired, drivers who are driving all night, who are stressed out trying to make their next checkpoint on time, and you can have the machine take over, that's going to be one of the biggest places where this technology can make a difference really quickly.
And I was surprised to read that there's actually a shortage of qualified drivers. So, you know, finding drivers that can do this obviously difficult and important work.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's largely because the work is, it's not particularly pleasant to spend your time driving a truck across the country for most people. It's not especially well paid, and it takes you away from your family or your home for long stretches of time. And again, we're not nearly at a point where we're going to get rid of the human driver, but the shortage could be solved in a couple of ways with this technology. And one thing Mercedes hinted at or talked quietly about is the idea that if you have a human driver who's going to be much less tired because the car is doing all of the tough work, you might be able to change the rules a little bit because the government has pretty strict rules on how much rest truck drivers have to get. If you can tweak those so drivers can do longer hours, you might not get more people behind the wheel, but the people who do have the licenses will be able to do more work, and that shortage could be alleviated.
Interesting. Let me get Wayne from Kensington to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Wayne. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you guys?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. I just had a question about liability issues. Say there was an accident. Would the non-driver be sued, or would the casualty end up like suing the car company for the automatic driving?
Wayne, let me toss that to Alex Davies.
Yeah, so that's a question that comes up all the time, and the short answer is nobody really knows, and that's because we haven't quite gotten there yet. It's going to be a little tricky. I think eventually what will happen is the liability will shift away from the human driver to the machines, but then it gets complicated because they're saying, well, did Audi make the car, or did Delphi supply the camera that did the car, or did some other company supply the software? And I think ultimately it's a thorny issue that'll probably be sorted out in the courts.
Oh, interesting, in the court. Well, that kind of makes sense in terms of liability. A couple minutes before I have to say goodbye to you, Alex, I was also reading that Tesla is about to unveil some version of a driverless car sometime this year.
Yeah, so what Tesla wants to offer is what you'd usually call probably about a level 3 out of 5 autonomous car, which means, again, we're talking about highway driving. And Tesla hasn't been super clear on exactly what they want to offer. And by offer, they mean the hardware is already in their cars, and they're going to send out an internet update where one day the car will, just with the snap of a finger or turning it on, will be able to do that. So it'll be basically highway driving. It'll be able to stay in its lane, maintain a safe speed and distance from other vehicles. It probably won't be able to change lanes on its own. So it's not that advanced technology, but the difference is that where most of the automakers are really cagey and conservative, Tesla, and this is the way it tends to do things, is a little more brash and saying, we're just going to do it. And I think that's great because it'll help push the question a little bit, because regulators have been pretty slow in addressing this and what kind of rules they want. And so if all of a sudden Tesla says, hey, we're just going to do it, and it's legal in most states because mostly by virtue of not being illegal, then the question is going to come up sooner and the technology is going to have to be sorted out.
Well, I would love to pick up on that. It's legal because it's not illegal. I'd love to pick up on that, Alex, but we have to say goodbye to you. Thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks very much for having me.
You're welcome. Alex Davies, associate editor at Wired, and he rode 500 miles in an autonomous car. He covers transportation for Wired, and we began our conversation with John Volker, editor-in-chief of Green Car Reports. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, listen to us on satellite radio, and much more as well. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.